Welcome to Profiles. I'm Christina Kuzmich, and my guest is Dr. Gene Temple, president of the IU Foundation. He's a nationally recognized expert in the study and practice of philanthropy and nonprofit management. The nonprofit Times named him one of the country's 50 most influential leaders in the nonprofit sector each year since the list was created. Before assuming the IU Foundation presidency, Gene served as executive director of the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University since 1997. His career includes more than 20 years in higher education administration, fundraising, and teaching. He holds faculty appointments in higher education and philanthropic studies in the IU Schools of Education, Liberal Arts, and Public and Environmental Affairs. Gene, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you very much, Christiana. Good to be here.
You're a professor of philanthropic studies. What exactly is philanthropic studies?
Well, philanthropic studies is a multidisciplinary approach in inquiry, teaching, training about a voluntary association, the giving of time, the giving of money that impacts our society through what we call the nonprofit or independent sector, independent of government, independent of business, that helps provide for the public good. One definition that's been used, created by Bob Payton, the first director of the Center on Philanthropy, is it's voluntary action for the public good.
You once said that fundraising is an art and a science. Can you expand on that?
Well, I believe philanthropy is, first of all, a human activity and has to be studied as a human activity. And fundraising is about engaging people with nonprofit organizations. Hank Rosso, the founder of the fundraising school, said that if fundraising is really about teaching, it's the gentle art of teaching the joy of giving. But fundraising, is both an art and a science. In fact, fundraising has a management side to it, and management is about doing things toward more or less predictable ends. So you can study whether different management approaches work, that kind of thing. In fact, there are a lot of aspects about philanthropy that one can study, about fundraising that one can study. For example, does changing the message here at the radio station when you're doing the on-air appeals, does changing the message change the results? And Jen Shang, one of the PhD graduates at the Center on Philanthropy, has in fact studied that very thing and found that changing the message does in fact change the results. But as people's philanthropy grows larger over time and they make larger and larger philanthropic gifts, there's also a lot of art involved. And I think that, that's the ability to listen to people, the ability to talk to people from their vantage point. The art side is the ability to help people experience some real satisfaction and joy from making philanthropic gifts.
As a teacher of philanthropic studies, have you noticed that there is a specific personality that is more inclined to be a good fundraiser?
Well, I think the personality involved in fundraising is almost contradictory. Fundraising takes somebody who has the ability to focus internally and do good management. And in fact, when you look at fundraisers and how they spend their time, most of them report spending about a third of their time on administrative tasks, managing the process, making certain that that things happen on a scheduled time period, making certain that you get the right kind of activities put in place. But it also then takes somebody who is kind of externally focused. So there are internal, external tensions in fundraising. And the personality of the fundraiser that comes into play, especially in doing major gift and planned giving work, is somebody who's able to gain the trust of a donor or a volunteer to work with a donor, somebody who knows how to listen, somebody who's engaging and can ask questions and draw people out. And then summarize and reply back. Those are the kinds of things that are really helpful. But if you're involving a lot of volunteers, the first thing is you have to manage that whole process. You manage all those volunteers in the process. So one can never forget the management side of it. And those people who do fundraising work thinking it's just a very externally oriented thing, you know, about sitting down and talking to donors or going to events with donors or having a meal with donors, you know, that kind of thing, and don't put any emphasis on the administrative side, will ultimately fail to be good fundraisers.
So those who can't multitask need not apply.
Well, it is a multitasking thing, you know, and sometimes the tasks are, you know, the tasks pull you in different directions at the same time.
Yeah. Let's get to the IU Foundation. So many of us know the IU Foundation as that imposing building on the bypass. But what is the Indiana University Foundation? What's its mission and what does it do?
Well, Indiana University Foundation is set up solely for the support of Indiana University. And in fulfilling that mission, trying to help Indiana University reach its potential in terms of service to the state, the nation, and the world, is an organization with three separate foci. It's about raising money for the university. It has people who help raise money for the university and help lead a fundraising team across Indiana University, including people right here at WFIU who raise money for a project related to the university. So fundraising is its first task. Second task is it manages those funds in more than 6,000 accounts to be distributed back for use inside Indiana University, often managing those funds back to the university, dispersing those funds back to the university, following the intent of donors who gave those funds. And its third function is it invests money and manages investments on behalf of Indiana University that are housed in the Indiana University Foundation. Some ways, if people know the community foundation world well, community foundations are typically set up to meet the needs of a geographic area. The Indiana University Foundation is like a community foundation for Indiana University. Its sole purpose of existence is to support Indiana University, but it raises money, disperses money, and manages money and invests money for Indiana University.
We're always in the business of comparing ourselves with other higher education institutions. How does the IU Foundation endowment compare with that of other universities?
Well, it compares very favorably. It ranks last year it ranked about 14th among all public universities in the country, and so I think that, you know, that's a pretty good place for Indiana University. We would always like to be higher in those rankings, trying to achieve even greater support of Indiana University. But of course, every public university today is trying to do the same thing: to supplement its state support and tuition income with private philanthropy. And as we work harder to increase the support for Indiana University, increase our endowment that can support Indiana University, other institutions are working hard at the same time. We're always competing for that number. Mm-hmm. Typically, we're not competing with other universities for support because the support comes from alumni and corporations interested in particular universities. So we're probably not competing with the University of Virginia for support, but we might be competing with them for attention. In terms of the comparative rankings of our endowments and annual income.
Are there any disciplines at Indiana University that tend to attract donors?
You know, if you look across the university at the places where most of the designated gifts come each year, you notice immediately the business school and the medical school. Medical schools typically in universities attract a great deal of attention. Business schools have corporations that are interested in supporting the work of the business school because the business school contributes back to the health of the corporate sector in this country. So typically those are the two biggest attractors inside a university.
What is the role of the IU president in the IU Foundation?
The IU president is one of our leading fundraising advocates, it's the simplest way to say it. But formally, he is the chair of the board of the Indiana University Foundation, which is the legal board that is charged with making sure the IU Foundation, as a nonprofit, organization operates according to its legal and fiscal responsibilities. But the president then has a role to play as the person who sets the vision for Indiana University, which drives the fundraising activity through schools, programs, and the work of the IU Foundation. The president is a person who acts on behalf of the fundraising process to interact with donors, to meet with donors on occasion, to help make the case for support to some of the university's major donors, to meet with donors at recognition events like the every year we induct people into the president's circle, recognizing those people who have a lifetime giving a record at the university of $100,000 or more. The president welcomes those folks, thanks those donors, and that's really his his opportunity to thank the donors who've been most supportive of the university. So he gets involved in the fundraising process, but he has a legal responsibility as chair of the IU Foundation board.
You're listening to Profiles on WFAU, and my guest is Dr. Gene Temple, president of the Indiana University Foundation. What motivates people to give money?
Well, people are typically motivated to give, first of all, because they believe in the cause. And if you do research about why people give, that's the first thing that comes up on the list. They believe in the cause of the organization and want to be supportive of that particular cause. And that belief in the cause is part of what begins to differentiate then why donors respond to some things and not to other things. They begin to sort these things out in their own mind. Building the motivation to that level is a very complicated thing. It involves, and this has been studied by a number of different researchers, but it involves, for example, having an experience in your own life that motivates you to give back to that particular cause. For example, someone who experienced illness in a certain disease might be motivated back, or had a family member experience illness in that disease, might be motivated to provide funds back, as I said earlier, for the medical school to do research related to that disease. Someone who has experienced higher education, like I have, as a way to change one's state in life and the contribution one can make back to society, might be motivated to support higher education. So that becomes part of the motivator. Some of the research shows that having an example in your own life, someone who taught you about philanthropy, who demonstrated by example how to be philanthropic in a certain way, that's a motivator, and that might motivate you towards certain causes. We know, for example, from research done at the Center on Philanthropy through its panel study, that children who grew up in households where parents give to religious causes are more likely to give to religious causes. And those who grew up in households where parents gave to secular causes are more likely to give to secular causes. So that the parental modeling seems to have an impact on the behavior of adult children. Those things are all part of it as well. There's this whole other set of motivators over there that you can find from the research. Many people think, well, people give for tax reasons, and that typically that's on the list, but fairly far down the list. That typically doesn't impact why people give, but it might impact when they give and how much they give. So tax considerations are a part of that. Now, we do know from some research that the center's done also that the cost of giving does matter, and people will, in fact, adjust their giving based on how much it costs them to give, and how much it costs to give is impacted by the tax rates. So when the tax rates go up, the cost of giving goes down because you can take a tax deduction. If you're itemizing on your federal taxes, you can take a tax deduction for your charitable gifts, and the tax rates have an impact on that.
In many cases, you can also invest by giving with a charitable trust, for example.
Yes, you can. There are very complicated tax structures in the tax code that allow you to make a charitable gift and also receive income at the same time. And right now, for example, charitable gift annuities are very popular because charitable gift annuities have a guaranteed income back to the person who sets up the charitable gift annuity. So you can make a charitable gift to the foundation and receive a gift, receive income for your lifetime on a guaranteed rate, and then the remainder of that original gift goes to the foundation to support a program in the university. But it's the guaranteed income side of that has really interested people during this time. So we've seen an increase in an interest in charitable gift annuities. But charitable remainder trusts, charitable gift annuities, charitable remainder annuity trusts, those things are all devices by which one can make a gift now, receive an income, and benefit the university at some later point at the same time.
Yeah, which is attractive to many donors.
Attractive to donors now, so that even during economic downturns, for example, people will make these planned gifts because they put the gift off into the future and allow some current income to come into the donor's life now.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that children often mimic their parents when it comes to giving patterns. Do you find differences in generations, for example, millennials versus baby boomers or versus the Y generation? Is there a difference in the pattern of giving or a difference in the motivation?
Some of the research shows that there are, in fact, differences among generations. The generation that's now in retirement, that Robert Putnam called the long civic generation, the generation that came of age during World War II, he found a database at an advertising firm, and that went on forever, with information that no one else had, and discovered that generation voted more. It had dinner parties at a higher rate. It experienced neighborhood picnics and those kind of things at higher rates. Also, that generation volunteered and gave at higher rates. And so the baby boomers haven't quite met that. Millennials are coming back. At the very end, we're seeing younger people more involved in volunteerism, more involved in charitable giving, and also more involved in studying about how they can be part of the sector. And so a lot of the programs that places like Indiana University and others are, in fact, they're a response to this deep interest among younger people in preparing themselves to work professionally in a sector where they think they can make a difference. The people who are in this, what Putnam called the long civic generation, their volunteerism and their giving were both tended to be a little more unrestricted. They had a higher trust in organizations, and they might give an unrestricted gift. They might give to operating funds in the organization, and they might volunteer just doing any kind of task, cleaning the floors here in your studio if that's what it took. They also tended to support more organizations in the community with smaller gifts, perhaps. If you contrast that with giving today, there's much more interest in restricting the gift and restricting the gift at smaller amounts. There have always been restricted gifts, especially as the gifts got larger, but today there are many more restricted gifts at smaller amounts. And the volunteerism is more ad hoc than it used to be. That is, I'll volunteer on Saturday morning with some of my friends, and it becomes a social activity as opposed to an activity just, basically for the community, to get engaged with the community. Boomers, when they volunteer, they prefer to use their expertise. So if they're accountants, they would prefer to volunteer in an organization using their accounting skills to do some financial work for the organization. So when organizations are trying to involve the boomers who are now going to be entering into this retirement phase, they need to think very carefully about how the skills of the person who wants to volunteer can be used in some real way inside the organization. They don't just want to stuff envelopes or clean the floors.
Which brings us to this next comment that I heard you made. 50 years ago, most people came from small towns where there was community. Today, in big, impersonal cities, people fit in through nonprofits. Elaborate on that.
That's a, you know, that's a paraphrase, actually, of a quote by Peter Drucker, who began studying the nonprofit sector in the early 90s. He turned his attention from the for-profit to the nonprofit sector. And it's a quote of his, something like that, that 50 years ago, even if they didn't live in a small community, they'd grown up in a small community. And that community provided a structure for their lives. It provided a place for them to belong. You know, he says the role of nonprofits is to build community. It's one of the tasks he assigns to nonprofits, one of the roles he thinks nonprofits fulfill in society. And what he says is that, you know, in larger, more impersonal cities and in these larger communities, the way people fit in and belong is through nonprofits. They find a nonprofit organization that has a mission that they can believe in, and that's where they find others who believe in the same mission. They can volunteer there with others who believe as they do, and it's a place that builds community. And so I think that's an important aspect of it, that especially today with younger people, they find a way to connect with their friends through something they all want to do together. With boomers, it's a place where their expertise can come into play. But inside an organization where they find others who believe as they do in that particular cause.
We certainly had an example of that in the 2008 election. Where technology was used sort mm-hmm. of as the meeting place.
And I think that is an important thing for nonprofits to remember, is that technology can be a meeting place, and that many more people will want to use technology as a meeting place, and the nonprofit can be a place where they come together.
When we first planned for this interview, our economy was sputtering along, perhaps not too well, but it was alive. And now, when we're conducting the interview, the economy is in the tank. How is this affecting the IU Foundation?
Well, let me give you some global perspective on the economy and philanthropy to start with. We know from research at the Center on Philanthropy, looking at 40 years of history of the national figures, the figures that are in Giving USA, and comparing those figures each year with the state of the economy, that the economy does have some impact on fundraising, for example, on the amount of philanthropy that's generated in a particular year. Typically, in a year when there's a recession, philanthropy will decline by 1% adjusted for inflation. And in years when there's not a recession, when there's a fairly healthy economy, philanthropy goes up by 4% adjusted for inflation. So there's a 5 percentage difference point between a good year and a recessionary year. In years when there is a longer recession, and there have been three of those in this 40-year period, when there's a recession of 8 months or more, the giving goes down even more. So what we know is that giving is impacted by the economic downturns. In fact, the biggest predictors for increasing philanthropy from year to year are, first of all, the S&P, the performance of the S&P. So an uptick in the S&P indicates giving will go up, and an increase in household giving. So we know that those things have an impact. We also know from some research that when economic times get difficult, households of $50,000 or less stop giving completely. They just stop giving. And so what most organizations experience, and the IU Foundation has experienced this as well, is that we see a drop-off in the smaller donors almost immediately. We see a drop-off in people who respond to something like the IU Telefund program. We see people responding to a drop-off in response to direct mail, those kind of things. So the IU Foundation itself is off in number of donors. We're hoping to finish the year down 10%, only down 10% in number of donors. The other side of that is the amount of money one raises. And right now we're behind when we take out some of the big Lilly gifts that have come in, which move our numbers around dramatically, because if we get a big Lilly gift one year and don't get that gift from the Lilly Endowment the next year, then that changes the numbers considerably. But even without that, we're behind a little bit in giving right now from where we were last year at this point. you know, it's one of those things that we have to factor into this. When the economy is not doing as well as possible, as well as it might be, people lose their sense of optimism about the future, and sense of optimism about the future seems to have an impact on their giving. The Center of Philanthropy runs a philanthropic giving index, and that index correlates very nicely now over time with the consumer confidence index. And so when consumer confidence is down, we can expect that there's going to be a lower philanthropic response. The performance of the stock market also impacts the endowments at colleges, universities, foundations, museums all across the country. And, you know, the good news is that our endowment at the IU Foundation is not down as dramatically as the stock market is down. So we have a portfolio that's managed. We have 80 fund managers. We have a great investment committee. We have a great team of staff people at the foundation who oversee the investments. And we've been able to diversify in such a way that we're not down as badly as the stock market. The bad news is we are, in fact, down. But that's to be expected during times like this.
We've also noticed here at public radio nationally and public television our transactional annual gift giving has gone down slightly.
Yes. Then again, that's to be expected. And most organizations will experience that you can expect smaller donors to stop giving. And even though there's been some response, probably more markedly this time than we had in 2003, to the needs of a community. So some people have stepped forward who might otherwise not have stepped forward, almost like the response to Katrina, for example, when you had a huge outpouring of small gifts from across the country to help. Even with that happening, many of the small organizations and communities that provide the food banks and the social services and the help the homeless and the help the jobless, those kinds of organizations, those human service organizations, have a more difficult time in this environment, because typically those are the organizations like WFIU, you know, where people count on these annual contributions for their operating support.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU, and my guest is Dr. Gene Temple, president of the Indiana University Foundation. And we're going to take a short break. Gene, what do you recommend that we segue into?
I'd like to listen to a selection from the Caswell sisters. My wife and I both had an opportunity to hear them in person. They're local artisans, They have an approach to a jazz that taught to them by David Baker and others, an impromptu jazz that really is very invigorating.
And, of course, the Caswell sisters are often guests on Just You and Me on WFIU. And here's music by Sarah and Rachel Caswell. Listening to Profiles. I'm Christina Kuzmich, and my guest today is Dr. Gene Temple, president of the Indiana University Foundation. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. You didn't start out as a fundraiser. Your background is pretty eclectic. In fact, at one point you were planning to be a hotel manager. Is that correct?
I was, yes.
How did you get from there to here?
Well, hotel management is about hospitality, and I think fundraising is about hospitality as well. But like most people my age who are doing fundraising work, I came into fundraising fairly accidentally. I was actually helping, you know, to administer a center that Vincennes University had opened in Jasper when I got involved in fundraising. And what the community needed to do was to raise money to help build a building. And I was out on fundraising calls with volunteers in the community, raising money to build that building. And I had no intention, of course, of doing anything full-time in fundraising, but became involved in it, as many other people do. I think that, you know, my awareness of philanthropy, you know, came from a variety of places. I, like most people, are, you know, a majority of the population will say they first learned about philanthropy by giving money in their church or synagogue. I had certainly done that. I'd experienced our family home burning. The volunteer fire department who, you know, came and tried to put out the fire, and then the outpouring of support from the community, you know, to provide clothing and food and shelter to get us through the through that time. But I was unaware of the other side of this, the work that takes place in communities very often to make sure that the common good is provided for. But I must say that when I first became involved in it, I became fascinated with it, about why people gave, why people responded, and that curiosity always stayed with me.
Can you go back to the time when you asked for your first gift and how that worked out?
I was on a call with a volunteer who was supposed to ask. He'd been assigned the task of having a conversation with this individual and asking for $50,000. Now, this was back in the days when $50,000 was still real money. The volunteer was having a difficult time with it. In fact, he finally said, after we both made the case, he finally said something like, "And we'd like for you to support this too." And the person's response was, "Well, I'd be glad to help out. Let me just write you a check for $1,000. I remember gulping and saying, "But we were hoping for 50."
You actually said that.
I actually said that. And so that changed the nature of the conversation, I remember. But in fact, the conversation ended fine. And what I learned from that was that you never really get shot for asking for money. In fact, one of my colleagues used to say when we'd get in the car to go on a call together, he said, "Now remind me again how you can never embarrass yourself by asking for money for a good cause." And that was the case here. And the response was after some more discussion, the response is, "Well, I'll need to consult my wife if I'm going to make a gift of that level." And in fact, eventually the person did make that gift. And I also saw then that these things don't just happen when you walk in the door and talk to somebody about it. But they often take additional visits and additional conversations to bring them to closure. And that was the case here. But all of that was done by instinct and accident rather than some planned approach.
Do women tend to give more than men?
There's several answers to your question. But first of all, the research that Center on Philanthropy has done on this topic indicates that women are, in fact, more generous than men, that single women give more than single men, and that married men give more than single men. And so it looks like women actually socialize men into giving. It's one of the little phrases we use at the Center on Philanthropy. But if you look at research and, you know, from the panel study in households and ask the question, who's decided to make these gifts? And in fact, women are involved in decision-making about philanthropy. And that even though men sometimes, especially in the generation that's now retired, that long civic generation, used to be a lot of male-type gifts. Men deciding to make gifts are appearing to decide to make gifts and do very public things like naming buildings and those kind of things, which is a lot less popular now than it was, you know, 50 years ago. But even then, that men consulted women went before those gifts were made. There are interesting things about this. You know, women make gifts differently. They behave differently in philanthropy than men. And, you know, that we have the Women's Philanthropy Institute at the Center on Philanthropy studying these things. Women seem to be care more about direct interaction, funding programs, and then interacting directly with the recipients of programs. They will say that they're really trying to make a difference with the programs as opposed to doing philanthropy for a lot of other reasons. And the thing we have to remember about women is that women now earn a lot of their own wealth. There are a lot of women wealth holders in this country. And B, women outlive men, and they often inherit wealth.
When young fundraisers first start out, one of the questions that always comes up, or one of the fears that comes up, is asking for that gift. They study how to prepare the donor, how to cultivate the donor. But when it comes to actually asking that question, that's where they freeze. What advice do you have?
Well, I think that it's not only people who do fundraising work, but volunteers. The most difficult thing for most people is asking for a gift. Often, people don't understand, don't understand this whole process. And people give to things they care about, and the conversation is about laying out a possibility that donor could care about this cause enough to want to support it. And the presentation that the donor, that the volunteer and the fundraiser make is about the case for support. And what you have to do is you have to set yourself aside and let the case be the power of that conversation. Not think that let your ego get in the way here and think that you are causing this gift to be made. And I think that's a lot of times the mistake that people make in this, whether it's a volunteer or a professional fundraiser, making that request, that they get themselves engaged in such a way that they cannot take themselves out of it if the request is turned down. And there are three kind of big fears that people have going into this. One is that we call it the fear of begging, not wanting to make ourselves subservient in that situation. Second is a fear of reciprocity. If I ask you and you give, you might ask me back. And that's especially true with the volunteers. The other is the fear of rejection. I mean, people simply are afraid they're going to be rejected. And again, if you let your person intrude into this and make this a personal situation as opposed to a situation where you're representing the organization and the organization's mission and the good it does in the community and those kinds of things, then you risk that rejection. I think the biggest problem is that all of us like to take credit for our work.
So the advice is don't take it personally.
Don't take it personally. Don't take the success personally, and don't take the rejection personally.
So much of your research comes to us from the Center on Philanthropy, of which you were the executive director for many, many years. Tell us about the center and some of its accomplishments.
Well, the center was organized in 1985 and 86 in response to a discussion with the fundraising school, which was located in San Rafael, California, founded by a man named Hank Rosso, who had expressed some interest in the possibility of doing something with this school, institutionalizing in some way after his own career. And we made a proposal that the fundraising school move to the university, to Indiana University, and the discussions then centered around what else might a university do related to fundraising and philanthropy. Could it do research? Could it start academic programs, et cetera? And a very interested party in that was Charles Johnson at the Lilly Endowment. And so funding from the Lilly Endowment actually helped start the center back in 1987, a $4.1 million grant. And I was not an employee of the center. I was a volunteer. I worked for the IU Foundation at the time, in fact, as vice president for Indianapolis, and helped put together that grant and then chaired the policy committee that organized the center and helped the center get off to a fairly good start. It also secured funding from the Kellogg Foundation and from what is now called Atlantic Philanthropies in New York. And so the generosity of those funders really helped the center ramp up very quickly. The center became a catalyst for the creation of academic programs inside the university, for doing research, for building a faculty inside the university, and then fostering fostering training through the fundraising school and other programs to really, really ramp those programs up. For example, the fundraising school, when we took the fundraising school, probably taught, 600 people a year in programs around the country. Today, it teaches more than 2,000 people in those regular programs, but maybe another 5,000 to 6,000 in special programs it organizes for, like the American Red Cross, or like it has a big training contract now with United Way of America, or it just finished a big training program for Habitat for Humanity. And it trains in every country, really not every country, but every continent around the world. The faculty has been built as a permanent kind of asset inside Indiana University. And I always say that that there are good people on the faculties of other universities, one or two here or there. But inside Indiana University, not only Indianapolis and Bloomington, where the primary faculty members are, but also some other campuses around the system, you can convene inside one institution probably the biggest talent base dedicated to study of philanthropy and nonprofit management of anywhere in the world. And, I think that was a big part of the center's accomplishment, deciding to seed and fund faculty members to generate faculty positions. Like Kirsten Groenberg here on the Bloomington campus is the holder of the Ephraimson Chair in Philanthropy. Her position was seeded with a grant from the Center of Philanthropy to SPIA to start the nonprofit management program that's offered here. There's an MPA with a concentration in nonprofit management in SPIA here on Bloomington and campus, and also at the IUPUI campus. So there are faculty members like that all around the system who've been involved in running the academic programs that are generated inside the university, and also doing some of the research that has made it possible, writing the textbooks and the books that people use in classes. So the students who come to Indiana University, whether it's for the Master of Arts in Philanthropic Studies or the PhD in Philanthropic Studies in Indianapolis or the MPA programs on the two campuses, they're going to have faculty members in class who've written the books, who are the experts who are cited who've written the journal articles, and all those kinds of things. They're really getting a first-class education in the program. And those things were seeded and started, through grants that the Center on Philanthropy made to develop courses, to develop research, et cetera.
Does the center offer online degrees?
The center helped, with Kellogg money, helped the SPIA set up a graduate certificate in nonprofit management online. So the courses that one takes to earn the MPA degree with a concentration in nonprofit management, that concentration is in fact offered online as a graduate certificate that people can complete wherever they are, and then even drop into a degree, an on the ground degree in their home community. The center also offers something called the Master of Arts in Philanthropic Studies in executive format. So people can come to campus in Indianapolis for 1 or 2 weeks at a time and finish 1 or 2, 3 credit courses. They do some work online before they get there. They finish up assignments online after they leave. But they can do this program over 3 or 4 summers and take some courses online in addition to that and not have to leave their full-time job in order to get a graduate degree.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU, and our guest today is Dr. Jean Temple, president of the Indiana University Foundation. We have only a few more minutes left, so we can't leave without asking you, what are your goals for the IU Foundation?
My goals during my tenure at the IU Foundation are to help develop across Indiana University the best fundraising team we can have for Indiana University, including people from the IU Foundation and those development staff members who work in schools and programs across the university, making certain that they're complementary, that we all understand our roles, that we support one another, and see ourselves all as part of one total operation. So it's to maximize the effectiveness of fundraising across the Indiana University system. So that's one of my goals. Second is to help align the fundraising goals we have inside the foundation and these units across the university with the kind of direction that Michael McRobbie has set for Indiana University to help achieve the vision through these schools and programs that he set for Indiana University. and then help the university figure out how it can do special campaigns inside those things, how campaigning gets done across this, you know, 8-campus system, and help the university get into a mode like that where there's constant understanding of how campaigns are going to be conducted, what campaigns might be next, how priorities will fit into those campaigns, that kind of thing. And finally, working with the foundation board and the university to plan for succession at the IU Foundation. I've signed on for a 5-year position as president of the foundation, and you know, taking what was an excellent organization with a leader in Kurt Simic who'd been there for 20 years, and managing it so that it can be accepted or taken on by a new president after me, after a 5-year stint, to come in and have the next phase of development for the foundation.
So you consider yourself a change agent?
You know, I am a change agent. I guess I like change. I like ramping things up. I don't destroy things when I come into an organization. I ask a lot of questions. I do what I call zero-based thinking. Ask people to assume that if you were building it now, how would you do it? I ask a lot of those questions, and those are the kinds of things I can do. And I'm asking those questions now, and I hope there'll be some answers, and there'll be some new thinking and fresh thinking about things, and that the person who comes in after me will find that kind of invigoration.
Indiana University has many schools, departments, and the college itself that are always seeking funding, and often from the same source. How do you keep them all apart?
Well, I think that one thing you have to recognize about philanthropy is that donors have interests. Foundations, corporations, and individual donors all have, you know, particular interests. Foundations and corporations will have even they have missions of their own they're trying to accomplish through philanthropy. So it's not possible for every particular program to seek funding successfully from a foundation or a corporation, and certainly not from an individual who simply doesn't care about that particular cause. So one of the ways that these things are separated is through what we call the prospect management system. That somebody from the university wanting to approach a prospect for a particular cause has to demonstrate that there is some interest in that particular program or project. And if it's a foundation, for example, it's very clear. One can look at the foundation's stated goals, and one can look at the foundation's past history of giving and see that this would either fit or not fit. And if one approaches a foundation with a project that doesn't fit, the foundation typically thinks you don't know what you're doing, and we don't want that to happen at Indiana University. So we counsel people about whether that might work or might not work. So those are some of the ways in which it's kept apart, but these things are separated and kept apart. But one of the jobs of the president of the foundation is to try to mediate this process when there are, in fact, competing interests. And in fact, the donor might have interest in two or more prospects. One of our major gift officers told me in a session one day that there's one prospect at the university who gives 64 different things inside the university. And so we do have those kinds of complications. And one of the jobs of the foundation president is to mediate in situations, especially with major donors, where two or more interests might be trying to capture the donor's attention, and try to talk to donors about which direction they would like to go, to put the donor into an environment where there are no competing interests in the room.
As you look at the future of the Indiana University Foundation, what are your major concerns?
Well, I think right now the major challenge is to come through this economic downturn and to bring the endowment back to its full value, and to help the organization, help Indiana University's organization, build a fundraising program that's staying in touch with donors during the economic downturn, so as the economy gets better, that we'll be there, top of mind with people. We'll have stayed in touch with folks. We'll not have lost sight of where we are as an institution, and as people are able to give more, have confidence in giving more, that we'll be there to receive funds. I think that The biggest concern would be that if we simply stopped raising money, or we simply stopped interacting with donors during this time, and had to start all over again. And then I think with our key constituents, it's a big part of the task right now. A big part of the job is managing expectations, that one has to have realistic expectations during these times, and at the same time be optimistic. You know, you simply cannot give up, but you also have to have very realistic expectations about what's possible in this environment.
Our guest today was Dr. Gene Temple, president of the IU Foundation. Gene, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
We opened this program with Johann Sebastian Bach. Then we heard from the Caswell sisters. Both were selections that that you chose. What musical selection would you like to share with us now that we're rolling the credits, and why?
I have very eclectic interest in music, as we've already demonstrated. I'd like to end with a selection from Amber Waves. The Indiana Repertory Theater in Indianapolis produced Amber Waves of Grain as a play, as one of its plays written by an in-house playwright. And there's music accompanying that. The play is about an Indiana farm family that loses its farm. I grew up on a farm. It's a very hard life, and several selections in that play relate to that, are about that farm life, and about in fact the family losing the farm.
We'll end with music from Amber Waves by local artists Tim Grimm and Jason Wilbur. I'm Christina Kuzmich for Profiles. Thanks for listening.
Take my hand, come walk with me, and I will show you these things I've seen, and I will give you all that I know. There are some things in your blood and in your bones. We will walk where there are no streets, where the sky and the valley meet. These amber waves.
The program you have just heard was recorded in January of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.